This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by Mook Delivery, bringing you the food you love. Mook Delivery, like McKenna, brings a top-tier lineup. With Leif Davis-esque delivery right to your door, you'll always be winning with Mook Delivery. So the only thing left to say is, you win. Order now on the McDonald's app, and you can also get rewards points delivered too, so that ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus. Rewards registration required. Points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hello and welcome to the Blue Monday podcast covering Ipswich Town since 2015. I'm Richard Woodward and you are tuned into a special show with me this evening and whenever you're listening is Mark Donaldson from ESPN. Let me firstly introduce with a long intro who Mark is and why he's here. It'll all become clear in a second. Mark's been with ESPN since 2010 covering a myriad of sports, football, tennis, baseball. Correct me if I go wrong, Mark, by the way. Golf, major events, World Cups, Euros, World Series of Baseball, Wimbledon, Australian Opens, the US Open, the Open Championship Golf, lead commentator for Serie A for ESPN and BT Sport. Or is this your podcast caps off that you do for BT Sport?
No, BT Sport has caps off, which is the baseball show. But among all that, you never mentioned all the grounds that I've visited. But you know what? I'm so excited that on Tuesday night, I get my first ever visit to Portman Road, Ipswich. Having spent the year writing about Ipswich and Portman Road, I finally get to visit it next week. How are you?
Yeah, the home of football. So I was going to go on to your books as well, because this gets to the crux of the matter. Your three books prior to the one that we're going to talk about has got an Ipswich angle to it. And Believe, From Turmoil to Triumph at Tynecastle, the story of the ill-fated era under Vladimir Romanov, who sacked George Burley, did he not? Harshly.
Harshly. He was top of the league, but he was getting too many plaudits, so the owner wasn't happy. So it was bye-bye, Burley. So we called that chapter, Why Bye, Burley?
Nice alliteration.
Yeah, we explained why he went. Do you know what? It's 15 years, Rich, since that happened. And I think it'll be for eternity for Hearts fans, that question of would Hearts have won the league under George that season in 2005, 2006? We'll never know. George thinks we would have done, so that's good enough for me.
Yeah, and we know about, you know, confounding the critics and the bookies by being near the top of the Premier League, albeit short and sweet moment in our history. And another book, Marine Heart, about Scotland midfielder Gary Mackay, who I think was very anti Romanov, if I've got my facts right as well. So yeah,
he was anti Chris Robinson in the beginning and very pro Vladimir Romanov, but then he kind of changed his tune like we all did. A little known fact about Gary Mackay: he scored Scotland's goal in Bulgaria in 1987 that sent the Republic of Ireland through to its first major tournament under Jack Charlton in 1988. I think that's the only book that I've done that doesn't have an Ipswich connotation, because the other book that I did, Stevie Nichols' book, another one that's behind me, of course, Stevie's assistant, was the man we're going to be talking about today, Mr. Paul Manning.
Yeah, so I was going to talk about five league titles and a packet of crisps. and another ESPN colleague there. So we've set up very well. We now know exactly who you are if we didn't know already. Mara Donaldson, thank you for joining us on the Blue Monday podcast, and a pleasure to have you. Let's cut to the chase. A fourth book for which you are behind the scenes as the author. We'll understand your role for that. Paul Mariner, My Rock and Roll Football Story, out this week, I guess, when we're putting this out, Thursday 25th-ish or something. But we've got some special events to talk about as well at Portman Road, as you mentioned. But let's start with some basics. How did the book with Paul come about? So it's been in the works for quite a while, isn't it?
Yeah, like I did with Stevie Nicol, I kind of asked Stevie way back at the start, like 2012, I think it was, with Stevie, do you want to write a book? No. And then a couple of years later, when Paul joined us full time, if you ever fancy writing a book, yeah, sure, I'll let you know. And then it kind of came about in February, March this year, when I just messaged him. And I wish I'd done it earlier, because he said yes. And the reason I wish I'd done it earlier will become clear, because I think I'm maybe the only ghostwriter of any autobiography who's never really had any time at all with his subject.
Oh, wow.
Which is, it's heartbreaking for Paul's family, for the Ipswich fans, for everyone who, for the England, Plymouth, every supporter who had some semblance of kind of love for Paul Mariner. It's heartbreaking that we're talking about him in the past sense now. We've got so many memories about that. But thankfully, Paul said yes, and we managed to get it done in time. I think, I don't know if it's a Scottish mentality, Rich, that you always look for a kind of negative in a positive, and that I wish I'd done earlier, rather than focus on the positive. Look, we've got a book coming out that should hopefully be a wonderful legacy for Paul's family about their dad, their husband, their grandfather, or whoever. But I would have liked more time, wouldn't we all, with Paul Mariner? Because you know what, as Ipswich fans will know, he just lit up any room that he was ever in.
Yeah. And it's, as you say, I mean, the flip side is it's a lasting legacy, and it's a story that sounds fascinating and interesting. And for someone who was born slightly after, I think just before, I'm trying to remember, I was born just before he left to join Arsenal from Ipswich, so I didn't see him play. But growing up as an Ipswich fan, you know about this team about 81, you know, the best team in our history. And what we probably don't know about is the other side of it. Unless you were around the club at the time, around the town at the time, you probably don't know about the anecdotes of Paul Mariner and the Beat and Butcher and Osman. And this sheds not only light on that, I hope, but brings people like me and even younger to understand what he's all about. So in that respect, it's a really valuable reference for all of us as football supporters, Plymouth, Ipswich, Arsenal, whoever. So we're all really looking forward to reading it, and I'm sure all of your hard work will be worth it. And as I say, it's a lasting legacy as well. So that's great. Talk to us about my first question was as someone at ESPN, talk to us about the post management career, the pundit Paul Mariner, because obviously that's the link between the two of you to for the book. But I guess as someone who doesn't have ESPN on in my house, it's massive around the world, and I just wanted to understand your perspective of Paul Mariner, the pundit, and the adulation and the kind of the respect that he got in that bit of his career.
Part of me doesn't understand it, simply because I don't know how many, we know how many viewers we have in certain countries, but it's not until Paul and Stevie and Craig and the gang that are on your screens every day, if you watch ESPN FC, go elsewhere, that they're getting a kind of an adulation from those of a certain vintage, our age, that remember his achievements as a player. But then the younger generation who've only ever seen him on TV or seen clips of him playing and never really saw him in person. So I'm not sure I actually understand what his popularity is outside of the United States and of the United Kingdom as well. I know it's popular because Africa's the big thing for us, because it goes out to show ESPN FC in Africa. And I have to say 90% of the mailbag is for the Premier League mailbag is from Africa, because there's just this huge passion over there as well. And it goes out in English-speaking Southern Asia and various other places as well. So I think me being at ESPN since 2010, having left Scotland, where I worked there for 33 years, it's not until you leave somewhere that you see that place from a different viewpoint, in that we're all in this little bubble. The Premier League's in this bubble, if we want to kind of magnify even closer. And fans of, even in Scotland, Celtic and Rangers fans are in this little bubble, that the world doesn't exist outside of their club or the two teams. But for Ipswich Town in 1981, and to speak to so many people in the book with memories of what they did, and even when they lost to Aberdeen, when they were defending their cup, and that was Alex Ferguson at the time as well, they were a big thing. Even when Aberdeen beat them, Aberdeen went on to become a big thing and beat Real Madrid. But from an Ipswich perspective, you've gone from this club that McMills played in Bobby Robson's first game, McMills played in Bobby Robson's last game, and it was a smaller club that not many people had heard of. But for all the people I spoke to, a lot of them with no association with Ipswich, but with association with Paul Mariner, they all know about Ipswich Town now because of what Paul did, because of what Paul's teammates did, and because of what the football team did at Ipswich Town back in the day. So it's easy to look at it and go, yeah, he's an Ipswich Town legend, but so many people know him for far more than what he just did at Ipswich.
And it's fair to say as well, I need to put a picture of the cover of the book up as well. We'll do that without covering our faces. It's worth saying that in the Ipswich era of his career, he transcended football as well, because the forward of the book is Ian Gillan of Deep Purple. I mean, talk to us about that. I mean, the title of the book, My Rock and Roll Football Story, it's kind of one and the other, really, isn't it? It's not all football, I'm assuming.
There's not much football. There's a fair bit of football, but there's so many other stories about things that he got up to. So he's in the office in 2015, I think it was, maybe March or April time, and he's going around everybody. I've got a spare ticket for Deep Purple. Does anybody want to come with me? Busy that night. I've not even told you what night it is. Oh, I'm so busy. So my father-in-law is a big Deep Purple fan. I said, Maris, I'll go with you. So, brilliant. So he said, right, meet me at the place. So it's in a place called Foxwoods in Connecticut, a casino. And it's probably, I would say, about an hour south of Boston, because it's near the Rhode Island border. So Paul stayed in Cambridge from his time when he was at Harvard University, which is all explained in the book. So he said, I'll meet you down there. It was a few days after he kind of asked. So I met him there. He said, meet me at 4. Four? The concert doesn't start till like 7 or 7:30. He goes, no, just meet me down there at 4. So I met him at 4. We went for a nice dinner, and it was still only 5:30. And I said, right, let's go. We're going to the gig. I said, well, what are we going to do for an hour and a half? Just drink? Because he did like a drink. He said, just follow me. And then there was a knock on the door, and it was one person was inside this room, and it was Ian Gillan. And honestly, it was like brothers. It was like best friends, because pretty much they are. And he said, in you come. And who's this? So it was the three of us sitting for an hour. And it was just the most bizarre thing. For every achievement and everything that Ian Gillan has done, he was one of the most famous rock stars in the world in the 70s. And then in the 80s, they split up, but back together at Nebworth in 84. Everybody kind of knew who Ian Gillan was if they had an interest in music. And now there's Ian Gillan, this rock and roll star. There's a footballing legend of the similar era in Paul Mariner. And there's me, this boy from Penicuik. And I was never treated like that. I was always treated like one of the three of them, or the two of them, sorry. And we got round to talking, and Ian was very magnanimous and a lovely, lovely gentleman. And he asked about my family, and I'd said that my father-in-law was a big Deep Purple fan, but he wasn't well. He was going through chemotherapy, had cancer at the time. And he said to Paul, hold the phone. And Paul's like, okay. So he held the phone. He goes, what's your dad's name, or your father-in-law's name? I said, it's Ronnie. And he said, hi, this is Ian Gillan from Deep Purple. I just want to wish you all the best, Ronnie. I know you're going through some hard times, but fingers crossed that you get through this and come out the other side. My father-in-law made a full recovery and said that was one of the best things that has ever happened to him. He didn't need to do that, Ian Gillan, But you know what? That's the type of thing that Paul does as well. These are two people who might be at the upper echelon of what they do, but the biggest thing about them both, they think about themselves before, well, everyone else has thought about before they think about themselves. And that's why I think, even though it seems the most bizarre thing that the forwards by Deep Purple's Ian Gillan, and it's a book about a footballer, the bond that they had, usually over alcohol and some food, was just something very, very special. And I'm not sure you get that type of bond between two people now in very, very different lifestyles.
It does feel like a different era type thing. But as you said as well, and even, you know, as I said, we're kind of at arm's length of his TV career at ESPN. But even when you saw clips of him, and as you said, I used to go on holiday to Australia and New Zealand and Singapore, and it would be on in bars there, and it would be brilliant to see him. But you get a sense of that, you know, he was there. I don't want to use the B word, but banter and that kind of stuff, that was always seeming to flow. And it wasn't, you know, there was insight, there was analysis, of course. But first and foremost, it felt like he was enjoying it, which is kind of what you want. And
of course,
that seemed to be, all of that, what he did was enjoying it, wasn't it?
It was. And the one thing I would say about this, Paul Mariner never changed from his time breaking into the Chorley side to the Plymouth side, to the Ipswich side. His outlook on life never changed. He himself changed, and as the book explains, he didn't like who he became after he joined Ipswich and he became successful, because looking back now, and he was able to look back probably from his latter time with Ipswich onto his time with Arsenal, he was able to look back at the person he'd become, and he didn't like that person. And it's all explained in the book, but the reason he didn't like himself at that stage, he felt he got too big for his boots, but his lifestyle hadn't really changed as far as going out and enjoying himself. So even when he finished, he became a bit of a nomadic character and travelled the world, came over here and went to Japan and various other countries, but he always had this fun lifestyle. So when he came to ESPN, he never had to change. He was who he was. He was what you saw on TV. There was no airs, no graces. There wasn't a kind of character on screen and a character off screen. And that was where he was very different from Stevie, because they're both pretty similar characters, but Stevie Nichol was very guarded when he came into ESPN. He'd just come pretty much from being boss of New England Revolution, where Paul was his assistant before Paul left to become part of the Plymouth backroom staff and ultimately manager. But Stevie came to ESPN. It wasn't until one of the senior producers had a word with him and said, look, as much as we enjoy having you here, you're offering us absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Because you're still, in essence, the manager of New England Revolution. You're saying a lot without saying anything at all.
Yeah.
Give us your opinions. Paul never had that problem. Paul's always given his enjoyment to it, his opinions, his stories. And that's the difference. And then when Stevie changed and became like that, the pair of them are just, I mean, the pair of them have been inseparable since a meeting in Framingham in Massachusetts when they in the first met again, having played against each other. But then they were very similar and they had nicknames for each other. They were both called Jim, which made it an absolute, All right, Jim. All right. I said to him, why Jim? And he goes, well, that's what Scottish people call each other, isn't it? I was like, well, not really. He goes, oh, well, it was when I spoke to Stevie. So he's Jim and I'm Jim, and that's the way it goes.
That must have been a fun dynamic to manage, to be under them. I mean, to the point you were talking about, you know, reflecting back on, because the success at Ipswich was in our history, pretty unparalleled. Obviously, the first division title under Sir Ralph Ramsey in the 60s, but it was so relentless as well. It was continual success as well. I just wonder how much... whether the book deals with the relationship with Sir Bobby Robson, because obviously he was very driven and very detailed oriented, and that kind of feels maybe at odds perhaps at Paul's philosophy. Is that fair to say? Is there anything around that?
Bobby loved Paul and Paul loved Bobby, and we've got an entire I wanted to devote an entire chapter to Bobby Robson from the some of the stories. I mean, when they went on a pre-season tour with Ipswich, Bobby had just left to take over the England managerial job. So they went to the Netherlands and it was just chaos. And they ripped the arse out of it, him and Butcher. I mean, they were playing Skittles with custard buns when they were pissed in the middle of the night. And the next again morning, the cleanup at the hotel on, there was chaos. And then there was the trip to Australia when Terry and I think Russell Osman made their England debuts and Paul was there. It was just before the Euros in, was it just before the Euros in 1980 or before the World Cup in 82? It was one of the two. And Paul was drunk and they couldn't find him and he locked himself inside a toilet. And Joe Corrigan, he was tasked with, they were rooming with each other and Joe said, "I've lost him." He goes, "How the hell have you lost him when you're on a plane?" So there's so many stories like that revolved around alcohol. But his time with Bobby Robson, hopefully the way it's come across, and let me explain, because I can't at the start say I hardly spoke with him at all and then suddenly come out with 80,000 words, predominantly of which are all Paul's. There's a lot of stuff that we spoke about over the years, which I didn't record, but I can remember. And I got tales from others about Paul, which at times we put into Paul's voice with his permission at the time. But a lot of this is possible because of a guy called Brad Feldman. So Brad and Paul worked together at New England Revolution, where Brad was the commentator. And they'd sat down together in 2010, December 2010, with the idea that Paul might write a book, so let's get some stuff on paper. And they got about 25,000 words. And I had no idea about this when I asked Paul if he wanted to write a book. And it transpires, I got an email after I'd put it out that I was writing a book and I wanted some stories about Paul. I got an email from Brad, who I know through ESPN. He's just up the road in Massachusetts. And he kindly offered for no charge, just the full transcript of the 25,000 words with Paul, which contained a lot. So there's that. Plus, there's the stories of all his Ipswich teammates, or the ones I've spoken to, and other teammates. Plus, I think we had about 90 minutes was the only conversation that we had when Paul had come off medication, because it wasn't making him feel good, because he was on various things because of the glioblastoma, the brain tumor. And I got a message from his partner, Val, who just simply said, "Today is a good day if you want to give him a call." And that was the last time we spoke, sadly. And it was an hour and a half of just fun stories and everything like that. So it's been very difficult, but I couldn't have done it without Brad and all his friends, his family and his teammates, who've put together the content and given me the stories and brought them to life about Paul. So the Bobby Robson stuff is a lot from Paul, a lot from others who were there. There's a good stuff about from I got this from Johnny Wark, who there's a lot from Johnny.
I can't wait, by the way, for this. I wrote my hands.
Well, there's a lot to do with fun and games, but the thing that interests me most was when the pair of them put their heads together. Now, that's not a meeting of the Brains Trust, I would suggest, but they kind of said, "Right, do you want to put a transfer request in?" Not because we want to leave. Oh yeah, not because we want to leave. Because we want more money.
Otherwise. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. We want more money. We feel that we deserve to be paid more money. Because what happened? That John Wark and Paul Mariner had both been at the World Cup with their respective nations.
Yeah,
chat. You know exactly what's coming next. A lot of chat. And how much are you on? Really? Okay. Now, this was around the time, was it the Pioneer Stand at Portman Road was being built?
Oh, no, don't talk. Oh, this is sliding doors moments. We keep talking about these. Yeah, sorry, keep going.
Yeah, so I'm not going to give too much away. But there wasn't much money to give them a pay rise.
Oh,
I think it was probably 83 that this happened, 83, 84, because Paul obviously got his move to Arsenal and Johnny got his move to Liverpool. But yeah, without giving too much away, that was one of Paul's regrets, because he would have loved to have, although he enjoyed his time with Arsenal, he would have loved to have ended his career. And that's what they discussed, a potential contract with, I think it was with Bobby Ferguson, who said he would go to the board and discuss a potential contract that would see him end his career at Ipswich Town, which is what he wanted to do. And it would be on a sliding scale, and that he would start off getting more, but he would agree to take less and then join the coaching staff and things like that as well. But ultimately it was denied because of the funding for the Pioneer Stand and various other things. And Johnny Wark ended up at Liverpool, Paul ended up at Arsenal. And
Milwaukee came back, though. Yeah, interesting.
He did, yeah.
I mean, his career kept going on in the 90s, though, didn't it? So, but yeah, I mean, coincidence is, if you like it, you'll be sat in that stand for the Rotherham game, by the way.
Oh, okay. So, okay.
You can enjoy your nice plush seat that should have got up on Mariners' wages. I mean, it feels like there's a good chunk which Ipswich fans listening to this podcast, which we'll be delighted to hear. Does this span the entirety of his playing career through to management and yeah. media work as well?
Yeah, and you'll not be surprised to learn that the majority of the book is focused on Ipswich Town, because that was the majority of his success. But it would have been remiss of us not to have mentioned Chorley. And this is where the internet was extremely helpful, because there's a lot of things that you can find there. There's stuff you don't really want to find if you go looking too hard. But I was able to find his former strike partner at Chorley. I was able to get in touch with Steve Walsh, who was the director of football at Leicester when they won the league.
Yeah.
And they were best buds, because they came from the same place. And Steve Walsh was the reason why Paul Mariner got back into football, because Paul had given it up to play cricket with Bill Beaumont.
I was going to say, that came up in the description of the book. I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, strange. I mean, clearly a talented guy, though, so, you know.
Yeah, but he'd just fallen out of love with it. Part of the reason was, and I think I've started one chapter with, I've always looked up to many people, but at the age of 18, I was still looking up to everybody because I hadn't grown in about a year. I think he was 5'3" from the age of 15 through to the age of 16 or 17.
So I guess it's a different era. He probably wouldn't have made it these days, would he?
No, and he was a midfielder. He was a midfielder until he went at Chorley. He was a midfielder. And it wasn't until, I think it was Alan Hampson, who had left South Liverpool to join Chorley, had seen him playing for Chorley the season before when he was out at South Liverpool, and thought, this is a guy who's got all the attributes to be a player further forward in the team. So he'd identified something about him. I mean, he played as a kind of a box-to-box as a 10 or whatever, but he saw with these hold-up attributes for Paul, and Ipswich fans will know all about that, and he was the one that moved Paul from, he said, do you fancy it? And that's why he brought the guy that he brought in, a strike partner from South Liverpool, because he felt that the two of them could combine. But throughout the book, I've focused on strike partners, because I've managed to speak to everybody that he was a strike partner with, from Tony Woodcock and Charlie Nicholas at Arsenal to Mickey Quinn at Portsmouth, even his defensive partner at Albany, a guy called John Harkes, who you'll remember as a former US captain.
Yes, yeah, US 94.
Sheffield Wednesday.
Sheffield Wednesday, yeah, brilliant.
Yeah, this 19-year-old kid showed up and he said, what the hell are you doing here, to Paul Mariner? And that was when Paul had first come over to the United States to play during the summer, because Paul was involved in the agency business after he left, and heavily involved in a crossover period of I think it was after the 86 World Cup, with an Arsenal supporting businessman called John Smith, who's done very well for himself. He was like one of the first super agents, and he was actually the European representative for Diego Maradona, all because Mariner gave him Ozzy Ardiles' number.
Wow. There's,
honestly, the number of tangents, Rich, in this book is incredible, and there is a little bit of time to talk football as well.
Yeah, wow. I love these kind of, how these things knit together as well. Yeah. I mean, it seems like chaos theory, or, you know, the butterfly effect kind of thing. But I guess that kind of sums up the man, really, as in, you know, maybe because he started, was he a mechanical engineering student and all that kind of stuff? And down to Plymouth, which I guess, you know, if you're going to go somewhere from, it's probably the longest line you could draw, then across to Ipswich. It's all kind of very...
Yeah, he was on the train. There's a theme about trains in the book. He was on the train heading down from where he was in Bolton or near Bolton. I think he got the first train from Bolton to Manchester and then down to Plymouth for his trial. And there was an old lady that got on somewhere and said to him, she kept staring at him, and he's looking at her, are you okay? She goes, excuse me, son, are you famous? And he said to her, he says, no, I'm not, but one day I hope I am. And that's the way it turned out. And he went down to Plymouth, and he played. This is what got me. This is when the research was very difficult, because I was told that he made his debut in a game against Penzance. And I thought, well, pre-season. Because Plymouth to Penzance, it was just the local kind of teams. I say local, that's still a fair trek from Plymouth. But he made his debut against Penzance. But it was actually after the season. It was in May, but it was after the season had ended rather than pre-season. This is what I couldn't get my head around. And I eventually managed to get in touch with someone down there who was able to send me the cuttings of the newspapers, for the local newspaper that said, yeah, it was Mariner's debut, but his manager at the time wasn't even there because he was with England under-21s and he scored with his first touch. So there's that story about the train, and then there's the story about the train up to London after he'd agreed to sign for Ipswich. And by the way, that deal went through simply because of the manager at Plymouth and Bobby Robson's insistence. Bobby had already met Paul, he'd taken him for dinner. Ipswich were playing an away game at Bristol. I think it was Bristol City, Ashton, maybe in Bristol City or Bristol Rovers, one of the two. And Bobby had gone from there with his assistant down to Plymouth for a Saturday night 8 p.m. dinner with Mariner at one of the hotels. So he'd already done that. This is, I think, the week or two before, because he knew that Ron Greenwood at the time had been sniffing around. Now, Ron wasn't the manager of West Ham. He'd moved upstairs. I think he was general manager at the time, but he was very keen on Mariner. And the deal was done on the Saturday night, the week after Bobby had met Paul and gone for dinner with him. The deal was done in the chairman's office with Ron Greenwood. He says, I'm not leaving without getting his signature. There was a verbal agreement that he would join West Ham United.
Wow. Did not know that.
Yep. And then Bobby Robson phoned the manager, I think, on the Saturday night afterwards. And the deal was agreed with Bobby on the Sunday. They went up on the Tuesday. He met West Brom, who were also keen on him, and West Ham had fallen away. Wow. He was so close to being a West Ham player, but he said he didn't fancy the London lifestyle. How about that?
Yeah, doesn't.
And look where he ends up. He ends up Arsenal. True. How many years later was that, when he was a little bit more mature? I say a little bit more mature because Paul was always someone that grew older but never grew up, and I love that.
Yes, that definitely comes from.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like home comforts. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home advantage with McDelivery. You in? Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Whether you need a VPN to protect your world online, to allow you to change your worldwide location virtually, or maybe a bit of both, NordVPN gives you the freedom to do so. NordVPN also allows you to stream TV shows, films, and even sporting events which aren't available in your local region, changing to a country which is showing that content, meaning you can switch as seamlessly as a Kira McKenna in-game tactical tweak with just one click. But that's not all. NordVPN can also look after you while online, preventing your card details and passwords from falling into the wrong hands, safeguarding your personal and sensitive information from harm. Think of it as a cyber Sam Morsey, offering protection to your own personal back four, but with far fewer yellow cards. NordVPN is available for the price of a cup of Bovril per month, and one account can be used across 6 different devices. Visit nordvpn.com/Blue Monday or click the link in the podcast description for more information about the offer and a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee trial period. You'll also be helping out the pod by subscribing.
Great. I mean, I don't know whether you know too much about ex-Ipswich legend who's got a statue about to be put up, Kevin Beattie. Yeah. His route to Ipswich sounds also involves trains, quite a few trains. Trains up to Carlisle, where he's from, trains to Liverpool, where he was supposed to be met by one of Bill Shankly's coaching staff, and he turned up and no one was there, and then he somehow ended up at Ipswich. That's of the era, though, isn't it? It's much more boring these days, isn't it?
Wow. Well, so I've got a couple more questions. I've got one more story about a train. So I'm like I'm like Billy Connolly, except not funny, and I go off on a tangent. And sometimes Billy went back to it. I get back to what I was talking about from time to time. But Kevin Beattie's tribute night, I think it was in Clacton, perhaps. Whatever it was, that's when Paul's partner, who he was with when he died, reintroduced herself to him, and they hadn't seen each other since 1984.
Wow.
Because she used to go to the terraces. She wasn't an Ipswich fan. She's an Arsenal fan, but she used to go to the terraces at Portman Road and stand by the tunnel to just to say hi to Paul. So they met again at the Kevin Beattie tribute night. So there's the connection there. And some of the stories about Kevin in the book that Paul has are phenomenal. My favourite train story out of the three of them.
Here we go.
Was shortly after Paul had signed. Paul drove up in this little Mini 850 and it blew up in the car park, the gasket or whatever. And so he's, I think it was Beattie that was took him inside and showed him. This is his first morning at a new club. So Beattie's involved there as well as a few others.
I could probably think of someone more responsible, but never mind. Beattie's probably best.
I've got so many of these kind of tales having written the book, and there might be one or two people that I've kind of, it was X instead of Y or whatever, but I'm sure it was Beattie with the long blonde locks that kind of, all right, son. So that was that one. But my favorite one was after the Mini had blown up and whatever, he had to get back down to Plymouth, but he didn't have a car. Because on his way from the hotel where he was staying with your wonderful chairman at the time.
Mr. Cobbold, Mr. John.
Mr. Cobbold, Mr. John, who used to invite him to play cards with his friends at lunchtime in the hotel, because that's what he used to do. Paul's this kid. Anyway, so he's ended up going back to Plymouth by train. The only way he was able to get back was by train. So he said to Bobby Robson, it was his home debut against West Brom.
They won 7-0.
Yeah. Mm. So you look back at that game, Paul Mariner didn't play the full 90 minutes, and there's a reason for that. So he said before the game, Bobby Robson said to Paul before the game, you've had a hell of a start. Your debut was at Old Trafford. You won by a goal to nil. This is your home debut. Your head must be buzzing and spinning. I'm not going to play for the full 90. If that's all right. And he goes, Bobby, thank you so much. He goes, I was going to ask you, is there any chance I could get the train tonight back down to Ipswich to see the missus and to get most of my belongings? And Bobby disappeared for 5 minutes. Hold on, son. Came back 5 minutes later with this. He had the timetable. I don't know how he'd got it or whatever, but he'd found a list and he'd written down the times from Ipswich to London, I think, and then from Liverpool Street, I think there's the Ipswich train, down to Plymouth. He says, there's one that leaves at 5 o'clock. Paul's at 5 o'clock because the game doesn't finish till like 4:40. He goes, aye. So I'm going to take you off maybe after like 65, 70 minutes. And then you can get showered and changed. And now is it Mal or Mel, who's one of the historians at the football club who used to work for? Yeah, lovely guy. And some of his articles seem to be fantastic, having read them. He drove Paul from the station at full time with all these adoring fans going, wait a minute, I've just been watching you play in the game. That was his home debut. And he drove Paul to the station to get the 5 o'clock train to get back to Plymouth. That's why Paul Mariner didn't play the full game that day, because he was able to get that 5 o'clock train. And he had an unbelievable debut. He scored a fantastic
quality goal. Yeah.
Oh, I said that was one of the best goals he ever scored. But he didn't play the full game that day because it enabled him to get back to Plymouth that night in time for match of the day.
Brilliant. This is going to be a treasure trove. There are people, including Dave Diamond on our pod, who will be absolutely salivating at the thought of reading these anecdotes. Worth saying as well, I don't know if this is a common for the other three books that you'd authored as well, is you. I definitely noticed you post on Those Were the Days and maybe a Plymouth Forum as well, getting insights from supporters. Is that something that you've done in the past, and is there anything that you've learned doing that process this time around?
Yeah, I think it's like saying, what's your favorite city in the world? Well, a lot of the time your favorite city is somewhere that you've got a friend who stays there, and they're able to show you all about the city that you might not see. So local knowledge, I think, has always been important to me. My background is radio and then into TV with Sky Sports, and there is that journalistic nous, I would hope. Now I'm a commentator, I don't have to rely on it as much, But I love the whole blank page and just being able to create. So it's something that I think is important, because all it takes, you might get 100 people getting back to you, and you're very grateful for that. But if there's one, that can lead to someone else. Then you can get those 100 and you can put that around. So the Ipswich Town fans were great. And what I'm looking for in a book is not to tell you what you already know or can find out. I want to add meat to the bones. I want to take you into a dressing room, take you into a pub. And they nearly burnt a pub in Ipswich Town because Ian Gillan used to like lighting the bottom of a newspaper and then putting it up his arse. And this was at the end of a night. If the barman said last call, he goes, So he'd try and set a newspaper on fire and say, I want another pint. And he always got one. But there was one night, and I know I'm giving away a lot of anecdotes. There's so many more in the book that are like this. You guys had a Saturday night newspaper. Was it the Green?
Greenin, yeah.
The Greenin. Okay. So Gillan's in town. He always stayed with Mariner when he was in Ipswich playing at the Gaumont or wherever he was playing. Is it the Gaumont or the Gaumont?
I think it's the Gaumont.
Yeah.
It was before my time, I'm really sad to say.
That's okay.
I think Gaumont. I'd go with that.
Yeah. Because Deep Purple had played there and then the Ian Gillan band. So anytime Gillan was in Ipswich, he'd always used to come there. So in the pub, and it's in the book, my apologies for not remembering the name of the pub, they always seem to go to him and Warkey and Russell and Terry and the rest. It's always the same characters. So Gillan was with them one night, and he decided that his party trick would be with the Greenan. So whoever comes in, he used to slap it down on the table after a home game with Paul and whatever. So one of them picked it up because he always liked to see how they got on, having just played in the game, but that's just football. It's like those footballers that like to see their man marks, and they're happy if it's 7, 8, or 9, but they're not happy if it's 5 or 6. But he'd taken the newspaper to the bar. I think it was Terry Butcher had gone up to the bar, and Gillan's on his hands and knees, sneaking around with a lighter, and he's lit the paper, and the bloody place, the bar nearly went up. They're like, get this out, and they're throwing it all over the place. The Greenan's on fire, Gillan's sniggering, man. I was like, what are you doing? But that was the type of thing that Gillan did. And there's so many stories with Gillan and with Paul and the Nebworth one where they're on top of a...
I remember you telling this one in the summer, yeah, wow.
Goodness me. They're all, so Nebworth in 84, so the Deep Purple is reunited for the first time since they split up in the late 70s after... a tour to Japan. I think they were in Tokyo and they decided they'd had enough. So they invite Paul to come there, and he's obviously invited Russell and Terry and one of the neighbor's friends who they lost. But the full story about that is in the book. So they're backstage beforehand and then they go outside, and Mariner, they're all on whiskey, so they're all steaming, and Butcher and Osman get up because they've got the perfect view by the side of the stage on this huge big crate, which, unknown to them, contains about £10,000 worth of fireworks, which would have blown the whole place up. So I told Gillan about that because Ian has written the I think, and it's not because it's just for Paul's book, I've never read a foreword like this ever, because Ian Gillan is a very smart man as well as a very talented man. And he writes in a way that is absolutely incredible. And I had told him about this, and he had no record. I mean, he's getting a helicopter in to Nebworth. I mean, his pals are important to him, but this is a big thing for a famous guy like Ian Gillan with Deep Purple reforming and being on stage. So he's not going to kind of know that. And it's not something that Paul and the guys would kind of talk about too much. I'm sure Russell did, because Russell was invited to Gillan's house. But Mariner was the only one of the three that wasn't on top of the fireworks. So... that was the one time. Well, but Gillan's, that's what Ian was saying. He was so surprised that was the case, because Mariner is normally the leader of the gang that leads them not into temptation and does various things like that. But this time, for once in his life, Mariner was sensible. Unfortunately, Terry and Russell weren't. But it was, thankfully, there was no harm done.
Blimey, I guess it's a good thing it was after our UEFA Cup win, because that would have... There's a fight again. I'll give you the details after we finish recording. There's a book by Kevin Finch about Kevin Beattie. Beattie missed a big chunk of the season by putting petrol on a bonfire in his house, and it went up in his face, and he they feel like kindred spirits. So we'll talk off air about that one. Before you reveal the entirety of the Ipswich chunk of
that is nothing compared to
we could go on all night as well, by the way. It's worth kind of talking through the process of finishing the book, which is obviously was a challenge, and we also want people to go out and buy it as well. So was it done prior to his passing, or did that change anything? Or because I think you had it was due to come out in the summer perhaps, and is now coming out in November. So obviously I don't want to drill too much into that because it was a really, really sad time for everyone, but just talk to us about getting the book finally on shelves and the process of doing that, if you would.
Yeah, COVID hasn't helped from a publishing perspective and from a printing perspective. My deadline never changed. My deadline was always July 31st, and I was able to submit it. Paul died on the 9th of July. It was when Stevie Nichol messaged me that just simply said, Paul's gone. I was writing the chapter 14, I think it is, about Ian Gillan and the music. Say music chapter. I mean, it's just a piss up, and fun and games. So I was laughing at. It's not what I'd written, because I'd written things that I'd been told or had got from Paul about everything that happened, and the content I got from Ian Gillan was phenomenal. So I'm kind of sitting chuckling, and then the text come through, and it's the most bittersweet emotion possible, because you're reveling in somewhere that you weren't, but you're reading about, and that's part of the other reason that the way I write, I want to take people and make sure that they feel part of something as well. Even although they might not have been born or were elsewhere, I think it's important that you can tell a story in a way that is easy to read, but is also very self-deprecating and humorous. And the humor came from Gillan and Mariner. The sadness came from Stevie's text. We knew it was a case of when and not if. So I think I had 22 days. So I was just, I was finishing up. I was in chapter 14. I think there's 22. It was basically a 16-hour job every day. The first few days were harder than ever, because it's just happened. But it made me more determined than ever that don't give up now, that you've put so much into this with Paul, with all Paul's friends. And Paul was never a quitter. So there's no way I was going to, I'd come too far to do that. And I had a family and all Paul's friends that had kept me going along, saying, come on, here's more, we can do what you like, we'll give you stuff and we'll help you out. They were desperate for this to be a legacy to Paul. So that last 22 days up until the 31st of July were intense, but I'm so proud of kind of what we were able to achieve. And then we were hopeful it was going to come out kind of, the earliest it was ever going to come out was end of September, start of October. But they've really struggled. And it's published by Reach Sport, who do many magazines, club magazines.
Programs.
And they're the kind of Daily Mirror's arm of publishing. So one of the biggest companies, publishing companies in the United Kingdom from a media perspective. Even they have really struggled to get paper, to get the printers, because there's such a backlog of things. So I have to say it was touch and go. This was nearly a spring release from what was going to be an end of September, start of October. We'd always hoped to get it out in time for Christmas, and thankfully we had that little buffer. But if my deadline had been any later than the 31st of July, and bearing in mind I'd only started writing it on the 1st of April, and I did 40 interviews as well, it was a hectic summer. I wouldn't have been able to do it had I not written the other three, because the first one you probably write about 150,000 and it goes down to about 80 because you know what you're doing, but you're writing a lot of other stuff and you're not sure what they want. We knew straight away, and this is the same publisher. They were called Trinity at the time, as in Trinity Mirror, that did Stevie's book behind me. So my editor, I knew well, having worked with a brilliant guy called Paul Dove, who really helped me. And without him, I wouldn't have been able to do it on time. And he then had the opportunity to get that edited, But he ran into the same issues as well. The thing was done. The frustration was that we couldn't get it on the shelves before now. But I'm delighted that we are now. And hopefully it'll be on sale for Ipswich fans prior to the game against Rotherham. We're going to be doing a signing session in the retail store at Portman Road, I think from 5:30 on Tuesday. And if it hasn't been delivered by then, we're all in trouble.
Well, you can just talk us through it, Mark. That's what we want. Next Tuesday, by the way. We're recording this Tuesday 16th, so this will be Tuesday 23rd. And it'll be interesting to get your, well, maybe we'll chat afterwards, your take of being around Portman Road, because the ground's a lot different. In some ways, it's very different. In some ways, it's not. You've got two end stands behind the goals that were modernised in the early noughties. But the stands either side, largely the same. You know, the old font on the cobbled stand roof, named after Mr. John, and statues outside of Sir Ralph, Sir Bobby, and in a few months' time, the Beat as well. So it'll be interesting. Have you ever made the trip to Portman Road before?
No, I've done many. My sister stays in the Midlands, but Ipswich is not one of the ones that I've done. I'm very competitive. My mother and father have been there. My sister's been there because my brother-in-law is a West Brom fan, so they went to see Ipswich against West Brom a few years ago. So now I can say I'm finally getting to go to the game against Rotherham. And as someone that used to collect Panini stickers back in the early 80s, I remember your pinstriped Pioneer jersey. And it was a bit like the West Brom stand. Some of the photos were taken, and there's this weird looking kind of seats in the background and the way it goes up. And when you write something or when you get involved, as I had to be to do this, you have to give your all to it, but you do get ensconced in this. And some of the stories, and there are many stories about Plymouth and Arsenal as well, again, predominantly to do with either alcohol or hijinks in England as well. But the Ipswich stuff, I'm trying to put myself inside Portman Road, having never been there, because Mariner and Butcher, they're knocking on the dressing room door of the away team in the Ipswich Town UEFA Cup run, trying to hell raise and everything like that. And they're singing, nice, and they're banging and they're dancing. So that was with the stand, excuse the ignorance here, is the stand, the tunnel still where it used to be, where I think they used to come out at the corner or just behind the goal?
Yeah. I think it's been ever present, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the corner of that new stand we're talking about, yeah.
So the another quick story without giving too much away, although
I feel like I need to rein you in, Mark.
Oh my goodness.
Selling books here. You're selling books.
As you've kind of heard, I start something. I'm like Magnus, and I've started, so I'll finish. I'm not very good at teasing.
I need
this,
a beep.
Yeah. There was a player, was the semi-final game against Cologne, and Marin, the guy that got sent off, the Cologne player.
Now you're testing me.
Mariner basically said to him, "I'm going to kick the shit out of you," because they were so amped up. And Millsy was the difference between Millsy, who seemed to be the best possible captain, and Terry, who was this hellraiser. But honestly, I've seen Butcher angry because he was in management when I was doing Sky and various other radio and TV in Scotland. And I got on well with Terry. He used to phone us up when I used to do a radio show, breakfast show on Radio 4th in Edinburgh. And we used to do this.
This was at
Dundee United, where he used to be a coach there, not even a manager. And we used to have a quiz on a Friday morning, and he used to phone us up on his way because he lives in Bridge of Allen in Scotland, which is near Stirling. So he was going up to Dundee, and he was still within the range of listening. So he'd phone up, and he was brilliant company. And then ultimately, I'm a Hearts fan, as you can maybe tell. He became manager at Hibs. That was kind of difficult because we don't really like each other. But I've always liked Terry. But he had this anger when he was playing, and he is the perfect leader. Was it the away game? I think he got the only goal in Cologne. He scored. Again, apologies if there's any kind of grammatical or I'm sure
I'm not correcting
sure
you either. We're complicit. It's fine.
Yes, I think it was him. But to the home game, Butcher's like, he's got veins popping out his face, and Mariner's the same. And there was a little bit of argy-bargy in the tunnel behind the goal. And this is where I'm trying to picture myself. It's pretty narrow and whatever. And Bobby wanted them to go straight out. And they went up to the away dressing room and banging on the door. And then their guy took it when they're lining up. And he, I'm going for you. I'm getting you. And he did. And he got him from a corner inside 3 or 4 minutes. The guy got back up eventually after treatment, played on for a couple of minutes, then had to be subbed. And Mariner shouting over to him, "Hey, up you." When he went, there's...
I didn't think he'd have that edge to him. But it mattered at that point, because our season, we had a treble at one point that was on. And I don't know whether that comes up. That's for another day, maybe. But
that comes up.
They wanted... That became suddenly the be-all and end-all, the UEFA Cup. So
it's funny that there's an... Sorry to interrupt. There's a piece that... I read an article on it was either the website that you guys do, the message board, but I had a link to an article about a goal that was scored. Did Paul Mariner, I'm sure it was Mariner that scored the winner against Villa in the FA Cup that season. And it was, did Paul Mariner cost Ipswich treble?
Yeah.
Well, not the treble, but the title, sorry, because they wouldn't have won the treble had they
played so many games. And
yeah, exactly. So the essence of the article was, if Ipswich had lost to Villa in the FA Cup, Villa would have had more games, Ipswich would have had fewer games, and ultimately, because Ipswich lost the semi-final, I'm guessing I get mixed up with my Manchester City.
Man City.
I think it was Man City, because Paul played in the semi-final of the League Cup for Plymouth against Man City. Plymouth, as a third-tier side, reached the semi-final of the League Cup back in 75, I think it was. And it was Man City again that beat Ipswich. And Ipswich should have beaten City. They were a better team and whatever. But the whole essence of the article was, if Ipswich had lost that game against Villa, they would have been slightly fresher. They wouldn't have played all those games, mid-60s, of which Russell Osman played in them all. Mm. Again, it's all hypothetical and everything like that, but things that lead to other things. But what a run. But there is a distinct frustration among everybody that I spoke to that played for Ipswich. They should have won the league that season. And Paul never won a league. He got promotion with Portsmouth. He got promotion with Plymouth. He came so close with Ipswich. But he never won a league title. He won the FA Cup with Ipswich in 1978, which he will always cherish. And some of the tales around that are phenomenal. I'm not going to spoil this one, but there was an incident in the tunnel beforehand that...
at Wembley? Say,
uh-huh.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that Malcolm McDonald won't forget in a hurry.
Wow.
But yeah, there's... I so enjoyed writing this as a football lover. And someone that got into football in the kind of early 80s, writing Stevie's book, I knew a lot about what he did, because I was able to, at the World Cup in 86, and then following the progress of Liverpool. Now, Paul's slightly older, but that Panini sticker of Paul, not at Ipswich, I think the first one was 84, so he would have been at Arsenal at the time, 84 or 85. Tommy Caton, Charlie Nicholas, Tony Woodcock, Paul Mariner, that's how I remember him. Then Panini 86 for the World Cup, Mariner with the long hair playing for England. Just so many kind of memories of that. And your memories get mixed up. I think I've got Paul playing in the 86 World Cup right there. He didn't. I'm kind of going over it. Of course, that was 82 World Cup he played in that. But there's just so many stories, and it took me into an era where I was besotted by the stories that you will get about Ipswich winning the UEFA Cup and the FA Cup, players going out and celebrating the open top bus parade. Going back on the way from Wembley to get to Ipswich, they stopped off at a pub because they promised that they were going to take the FA Cup in.
Remember that? Yeah.
And they're all pissed, and they couldn't get them back on the bus because they're like, "No, well, we're just going. Why? What's the difference between celebrating in the pub and celebrating back? You know, all your friends and your family and all the fans are back in Ipswich." Yeah, okay. So trying to get them out the pub, having gone into the pub, but stories like that. So my aim has been to take the reader and make them feel like they're on the bus, they're in the changing room, they're on the field, They're drinking with Ian Gillan and Paul Mariner. They're at Nebworth. That's what I've tried to do. And the proof of the pudding will be in the eating.
Mark, it sounds fascinating. And it sounds like an amazing amount of work. I feel like you're part kind of author, part detective.
My father was a detective inspector. So I think part of him has rubbed off on me in that I'm like a dog with a bone. And if I find something and I don't, there's one thing missing, but I think I can get it. I'll not let up until I get that. And by doing that, I was able to uncover probably more than I would have done normally. And that it's the tangents that lead to that little thing. Speak to someone, it leads to that big thing. And then it brings other people in. You can get their viewpoints on it. And the wonderful lady, I mean, one of my favorite conversations of all the 40 or so people I spoke to was a lovely lady by the name of Pat. And
Pat
I'm
Gobbold.
Sure you know. Yes. And
yeah. Legend.
Yeah. Oh, one of the nicest people. The only thing, I was just convinced she was going to offer me a cup of tea. And everything was done virtually. And I'm in America and she's over there. But I can see why she was so beloved, and to read and then write about her being in the Ipswich Town Hall of Fame, along with Mariner and everyone else, that kind of summed up for me the kind of football club that Ipswich Town was, and not knowing it as a club, hopefully still is, and will continue to be, because it seems like a wonderful football club with a fantastic fan base. And it's a community club. There's something about being a one club town or city. With Hearts, we share it with Hibs. We've got the rivalry. You guys have got the rivalry with Norwich, albeit it's up the way. But there's that. And the time that Paul played and the time that Stevie Nicol played, I don't know what kind of autobiographies you're going to get from Raheem Sterling and various others in years to come. They're probably going to read like Anne Frank's diary. Stayed in, stayed in, stayed in.
Because,
it's not their fault. This is the world we live in now, but they're recompensed for that. And they're paid very well for that. But there aren't those stories. So these are the kind of last stories that you're able to tell of those that played in the 80s and the 90s. Because once it gets to the kind of current day players now and their autobiographies in years to come, of course they'll sell well. People will just buy them flippantly, but they're not going to be those stories. But to have all those stories, you've still got to have people willing to tell them and to elaborate on them. And the reason they're able to do so is because there is no evidence. There is no social media, because a lot of them wouldn't be told without that. But thankfully, we can tell them on their behalf.
Yeah, and your book is going to be a fantastic legacy that does that and introduces Paul to a whole new era of Ipswich Town fans, and for that we're massively grateful. I'm really excited to read it myself, having spoken to you now. So thank you so much for giving us your time and putting so much time into the book as well. And obviously it covers more than just Ipswich, but really grateful as an Ipswich Town fan to read about those heroes from that amazing era for us. And the community club, hopefully you'll get to experience it. Maybe it lost its way for a decade or so, but hopefully there's a feel that it's getting back that way. And actually Pat Gobwell was at a ITFC supporters Q&A only a couple of weeks ago that I was at, and talking about all the memorabilia in the in the director's box and all that kind of stuff. So maybe you'll even get to see some of that.
Yeah, she had her suit as well for the FA Cup final in 1970. Wow. And I'm sitting there, Rich, and she's telling me all these wonderful stories. I'm in tears. She goes, "When I go eventually, I want to be buried in that blue suit." I've never met you. You seem like the most perfect and nicest person in the world, and you've got me in floods of tears. There was a lot of tears that went into this book. Thankfully, the majority of them were tears of laughter. But the one thing, and as it got towards the end for Paul, and I'm still doing the interviews, people by that stage know that he's not well, and they probably know they're not going to get another opportunity to talk about Paul. So there were moments where it got emotional with the people I was speaking to, with myself. I think the first interview I did was Kevin Painter at the end of March.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we did the darts. The last interview I did was Jurgen Klinsmann.
Wow.
Because Jurgen got Paul into Toronto FC when Jurgen was there and Paul came in after that. So I think that is a kind of summation of the way the book is. I've started with Kevin Painter, a darts player who's a super lad, and I've ended with Jurgen Klinsmann, and everything in between is just chaotically mad, which I love about Paul, and I always will.
Brilliant. Brilliant stuff, Mark. Thank you so much for taking us through that. I really appreciate it. We need to kind of talk about where folk can get the book. I'll put the picture up here. We'll obviously tweet it out. But yeah, Paul Mariner, My Rock and Roll Football Story, out, depending on when you're listening to this, I think Thursday 25th-ish. But
it should be out on the Tuesday night prior to
yeah,
the,
tell us about that quickly. And what I'll do is I'll just put your social media up as well. So Donaldson, at Donaldson, have I got the ESPN? I have, right, yeah. Donaldson, ESPN. We'll tweet about this from the podcast channel as well, so you'll see that there. But yeah, just briefly remind us of Tuesday 23rd.
Yeah, so this is the 16th when we're recording. The publishers are due to receive copies of the book, but the majority of the first copies of the book are going direct to the Ipswich Town store, the retail store at Portman Road, because they've placed a decent-sized order. And 30% of the profit that Ipswich Town make on the book is going to the Brain Tumour Charity. So they have kindly agreed to do that. What I'll do as well, Rich, I will send you the link to direct to the publisher's website. Over here we have this thing called Black Friday. It seems to have seeped into your culture as well. Don't complain. There's a 40% off. I think you can get the hardback for about £11.50 instead of £18.99 by ordering online as well. And you should have that by next week. So, yeah, the big chunk of the profits that Ipswich Town make on this is going to the chosen charity of Paul's family. So that's a magnanimous and magnificent gesture from the football club. So yeah, they hope to have it on sale at the start of next week. And the plan is that we will be able to sign some of them. I don't want to devalue it for you, but I'm meant to be there from 5:30, I think, next Tuesday. And then looking forward to Ipswich Rotherham and my first taste of Portman Road. And
that is going to be a feisty one as well.
Yeah, yeah. And the only thing I wish for that was that Paul would be sat beside me. But
yeah, not. It's a shame. Yeah. But the book is the lasting legacy, as you say, Mark. And on behalf of all Ipswich Town fans, and I'm sure Plymouth, Arsenal fans, and Deep Purple fans as well, it's like for everyone by the sound of it. Thank you so much for that. Thank you so much for speaking to us as well. It's been an absolute pleasure hearing about this book and looking forward to reading it. We've had a show in mind for a while. We want to find a football book and get all of our subscribers reading it and then having a bit of a conversation about it.
So that'd be cool.
This one might be the one. Let us know in the comments if you want to do that. All of our details, as always, you can find at bluemondayitfc.co.uk. We might even get Mark on to do a little, maybe get you to read a bit of it or something like that. We'll get you involved, I'm sure, in that one. But once again, Mark, Donaldson at Donaldson ESPN, if you want to get in touch with Mark and find out all about what he's doing. And Planet Blue, Tuesday 23rd before the Rotherham, go and say hello. Mark, thank you once again. That was great. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's the promotion running. Everyone is gathered round to watch. The McNuggets share boxes are there, offering much needed distraction. Your mate's already been booked for double dipping, but in you swoop to steal the last nuggets and claim all 3 points. Oh, and there is the Harry Clark fist pump to celebrate. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in at participating restaurants.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.